Okay. So it's a pleasure to be here to talk with you about screening, and we're going to be talking today about a national survey that we did back in 2010, trying to figure out what commercial health plans, which I suspect most in this audience today are covered by. We're talking the Blue Cross, the Aetna, the Cignas of this world, although we don't tell who responded to our survey. But that's the kind of health plans we're talking about. And what do they do about screening? And you might think, how does health plan enter in? It's a clinician that screens. Well, hopefully you'll be surprised to find out that it's more than that by the end of this presentation. I'd like to acknowledge our funding, which is from NIAAA and NIDA. I'd like to acknowledge our team, which is directed by my colleague, Connie Horgan, and includes myself, Maureen Stewart, Sharon Reef, Elizabeth Merrick, Dominic Hodgkin, Amity Quinn, and Tim Creedon. So today I'll give you a probably not much needed background on screening, overview of our survey methods, and then dive into our results and briefly conclude. So we all probably know that there are a lot of people with unhealthy use that can be detected in primary care, and that screening has been found to be effective with less severe alcohol use, be least effective for more severe cases, but it also can increase the percentage of people who enter specialized care. A lot of good reasons why screening is a good thing to do. Therefore, you'll be not surprised by this next super jazzy, we're so proud slide that I stole from my colleague, to say that everyone and their cousin has endorsed screening in general and screening in primary care. You see all the named organizations up there. There's not too many that would say screening, bad idea. Other potential benefits, unless you're not entirely convinced, is that screening can help to improve medical conditions that are associated with unhealthy substance use, prevent some medical conditions, that there's a lot of cost reasons, SBIRT saves money, and that it improves workplace performance. So it's great. It's great. What's going on with it? And one more idea is that you can have screening in a lot of different ways. It can be by primary care providers. It can be by the disease management incorporated in with the disease management. And that health plans have things that they can do, that they have levers they can pull, push. They can say, you must do it, and do it. They can offer payment. They can do other things. And so what are those health plans doing? When you are screened by a clinician in your health plan, when you receive something in an email from your health plan, how did that happen and how prevalent is that? So our research design is that it is a national survey. We've done it three times in 99, 2003, 2010, about to go into the field in 2014. We phone up private health plans and talk to head honcho types there. I should be more formal because I know they're recording this today. But and we pull out all the stops. If you tell us your name and we think that you know someone in a health plan, we will call you to ask for your help in refusal conversion. And that's how we got the high response rates in the 90 or so neck of the woods that you see at the bottom here. Over the course of and we work with 60 study sites that are across the country. And by doing this, based on a study done years ago that set up this sample frame, we have nationally representative estimates. We ask about each market area. So we might call a health plan, say Aetna, and say, Aetna, in your Seattle market area, do you do this? Do you do that? Do you do the other? And we do that for the different market areas shown here. There are many research domains in this very large survey, and we'll be talking just about a couple of them today. We'll enter in basically the plan characteristics and the primary care component we'll enter in. And we'll be using the questions that we asked about screening. So we asked, do you use general tools? By this we mean sort of a wellness screen that would include screening for alcohol or other drugs. Or do you use specific screening instruments, such as the audit, for example, for alcohol? We asked them if they included screening in disease management, and we asked them, how do you encourage it? What do you do? So we'll talk about four or five questions that are specific here. So the research question one is, do health plans require, underline the word require, the use of general and specific screening instruments for alcohol problems in primary care? That is, do the health plans go out to the primary care doctors in their network and send a note and say, we require this, you must do this, you must do it this way? What's a guess? What do people think?
No.
What? Give me a number. Somebody shout out a number, a percentage.
75% yes.
75% yes.
I'm an optimist.
You are an optimist. Any others? 50. Okay.
37%.
You've read our papers. So here's what we're showing in 2003 and 2010 for alcohol screening in primary care. Weirdly enough, it declined. That 21% now in 2010 require any alcohol screening, underline the word require. And of those, 69 or 70% require a specific tool. They say, you should do it, you have to do it, and you have to do it using the audit. So this is lower than we sort of were hoping it would be. So is that paint a dismal picture? Maybe not. We'll find out. So what this one is showing is that vast blue says no requirements. This is really another way of showing the material from before. That, and this is 2010, that a purple sliver say throw it in with wellness. The yellow says only do the one thing we suggest you do, and the green says use both. So we go to the next question. Do they provide financial incentives for primary care doctors to do this screening? Yes, no? Yeah. So of the ones that require it, a third of them give some incentives. And the numbers start to get small, so we don't really know what these incentives are. But they 31% provide incentives to do some kind of screening. But look at that. That's alcohol, drug, mental health, or medical. There's some kind of screening that you have to do. So this could be whatever, blood pressure, et cetera. And of those, 19%. Who require screening, well, the third that requires screening, so the 27%, 19% have incentives. So this requirement thing and the incentive thing is not going to hit all of us who are insured. So the next question is, do health plans directly screen the enrollees themselves? Do they send you an email? Do they do it through your health plan? Have you heard from Tufts Health Plan asking you something? Here's another, what do you say? Anybody? Norma, what do you think? High, low?
35%.
Any other optimists? Okay. In fact, 91% report screening for alcohol, drug, or mental health by phone, mail, or web-based surveys. And of those, they do something with it. 25% actually, of that 91%, actually get back to your PCP and say, hey, screened Deborah by the web, and she said she's drinking who knows what. I don't know if they actually get back if it's low levels. I suspect not. And 99%, a positive response triggers a follow-up through the health plan to the enrollee. So as we begin to build this picture, and so this puts those two together. It says 75% only do it themselves, but that 19%, that yellow percent, both does it themselves, the health plan does it, and they require the PCP to do it. That's sort of the belt and suspenders crowd that do both of those things. 3.5% of plans report nothing. They just sort of leave it alone. Health plans also included in disease management. Just about every health plan has a disease management program for chronic medical conditions. We show here congestive heart failure and diabetes in the super high 90s. What's fascinating, though, is that half of those plans also have routine alcohol screening within that group of people. So finally, We ask ourselves, do they support SBI for alcohol problems in primary care? Let me just say something about a word you're going to see on the next couple of slides, and that is encourage. We say encourage because we want to give these health plan respondents a socially acceptable answer. And so we've gone back and forth, require, encourage, require. So let's take in mind that previously we were talking about the word require. Now we're going to be turning to the word encourage. So this one, the first part of it, the left hand, is that they permit PCPs to bill for SBI. So that's important. They pay for it. And pay for it is probably the highest form of encouragement, I would say. But a 96%, and here's this socially acceptable thing, do you encourage SBI? Well, of course we do. So we asked the follow-up question, what do you do to encourage SBI other than, you know, gee, that's a nice thing to do? 99% say they provide guidelines. Useful, perhaps, to post guidelines for SBI on their web. That's probably how they do it for a clinician's part on the web. Not probably that much of an incentive. But 50% say they provide some kind of financial incentives for SBI to primary care doctors. 40% give feedback, and a small number give, or small proportion give training or recognition. So in conclusion, if you had just looked at the part about primary care requirements, you might have thought that there's a fairly dismal picture because, as you're recalling, probably about 27% require a screening in primary care. However, what we found in 2010 was that health plans used a broad range of approaches. And so that you can have a more positive picture that the health plans, through doing their own screening, through paying for it, through providing incentives, through including it in case management or disease management, sort of wrap their arms around it in a variety of ways. So it's the first glance at requirement in PCPs is really a misleading kind of conclusion. At the same time, this is a survey of what health plans are doing. It's not even a survey of what primary care for clinicians asking what they're doing. So the results don't really show us the level of screening in primary care. We think that the future research in this area should address policies to improve implementation in primary care and in clinical practice in general. Because of the introduction that Anne gave me, you'll know what I would think would be a way to do it, which would be to develop performance measurements, since that's what I love to do. But I think that that would be a good thing to do, because you could then pin incentives to meeting performance measures and use performance measures as a tool to improve levels and amounts of screening. So that's it, and thank you for offering to let me provide a picture of screening in health plans.
I want to thank our panelists because everyone was incredibly precise and succinct and focused. And I'm going to open it up to questions. But before I do that, I want to welcome and encourage all of you who are here today to join us for our ATOD reception and award ceremony this evening at 6:30 in room 104B. Just in this neighborhood. I'm going to begin the Q&A, and I am going to ask the speakers to come up here because there will be no more slides, and then you can speak into the microphone because, as Deborah said, the session is being recorded. I'm going to start with this question to Scott because I felt like I needlessly cut him off a bit. And what was the most important finding that was not included in your presentation that you would like the audience to know about? And then.
Most important finding. I think that maybe the most interesting thing to me in the process, that's an old speaker trick, you know, like the question, just answer a different question. So I think the most interesting thing to me is to think from a psychologist's perspective of how would you make the computer more like a person? how would you anticipate and capture people's responses? And one way we do this is by taking a lot of the assessment tools that many of you use on motivation and problems and expectancies and planning and efficacy, and we flip them. We flip them to be able to capture how a person is answering in terms of so let's say motivation. If you can identify what a person's kind of their pattern of motivation is for this person, is it more about the legal trouble? Is it more about the money? Is it more about the monitoring? Is it more about the social relationships? And so if you have an assessment like that, and you can ask a person to answer just a few questions, then you know something about that person. And so if it's a person for whom social relationships are the most important part of their motivation, now the voice can begin to talk in terms of that, and that theme can then reappear throughout the program. And so we use that, I guess, trick lots of different points where we ask people to answer questions about motivation and expectancies and efficacy and risk perception, and having that reappear at critical junctures.
Now I'd like to open up the floor to others in the audience for questions. Yes.
I'll follow up with you about, I've worked, do some work with a lot of people who are on probation, recently released from incarceration, and I'm wondering what education level your wonderful tool is used for, useful, and what is the setting that you're expecting to, or hoping to use this in?
In the clinical trial, we use a project laptop, so it's done under relatively controlled circumstances in the probation office. So people are handed, they complete the assessments, our baseline assessment, they're handed a computer, and just a touchscreen laptop, people just touch and move things. They have little headphones on, and they just sit down in the office and do it. So that's the setting it's done in the clinical trial. In the real world, it could be done in a waiting room, a kiosk, it could be accessed from home. There's lots of different possibilities.
And educational level?
Education is not an exclusion criteria for us, and so we have people of all different education levels. What we found early on was this question about literacy. And the whole thing is narrated. Every single thing, that you've seen some speaker buttons at points, even when there's a list of things and people are asked to click, they can click on the little speaker button, it'll read things. And so we have really, I don't think we have any trouble with literacy because the whole thing is narrated. We ran the script through a, and that's one way to do it, is run the script through a literacy level. And it's kind of around the sixth grade literacy is just the voice. You're not really supposed to do that with a narrator voice, but we did it anyway, and it's pretty listenable. What's the word? It's not readable, listenable.
Thank you. Another question for the Mac.
Okay, would you stand up, please?
Yeah.
Thank you.
So we're in the middle of the clinical trial. It's being tested in two different settings, in Dallas County probation and Baltimore City probation. And we're testing either a two-session motivational interviewing style intervention, a human intervention, versus the two-session computer intervention versus a control group. And so we're just in the middle of the clinical trial right now.
So stay tuned for
next year.
Good.
And the next question, please, sir.
On the issue of screening, requiring versus encouraging, yesterday in a session on integration, a primary care physician talked about how many possible screenings could be imposed. There's screening for alcohol, there's screening for depression, there's tobacco screening. Tobacco people would have you interview people in the elevator and hand out gum and patches. At some point, is it not better to encourage and perhaps do more harm than good to require multiple screenings at every primary care encounter?
So I think the question is, how is screening going to work given the multiple screens that are now available under the ACA and what is encouraging both the provider and the patient, and what is too much? Okay. Deborah, do you want to take it from there, please?
I'd be happy to take a try, but I don't think I have a better answer than probably any of the rest of us have about this. We believe that alcohol screening and screening for other drug disorders is important, and therefore I was pleased to see this multi-phase, multi-faceted approach to screening, and that to consider that it maybe does not all need to be in the primary care arena. I think there's a lot of really fascinating future interesting approaches, particularly as we move towards integrated environments, particularly as we move towards something that would be a difference between just offer some encouragement and let every clinician decide, but perhaps offer some guided encouragement as we move towards electronic health records. There could be direct screening electronic approaches with clients. As we move towards having longer term electronic health records, it could be that someone who screens negative for 8 years, you might not necessarily be wanting to screen them constantly for smoking or other particular kinds of things, including alcohol or other drug use, sort of this sort of smart screening approaches. So I think you're right that there's a very strong problem of overloading a primary care visit as we traditionally think about it. There's a lot of opportunity for interesting and innovative ways to get screening to occur. And I think that's what we're seeing among the health plans, that health plans and new treatment settings are all looking for those kinds of integrated ways. And perhaps the biggest motivator in all this could be payment policy. It could be that under bundled payment, under accountable care organizations, that the payors, the organizers, have a greater incentive for us all to be healthy. And that's going to also have a motivation in how to do that. It might be screening. It probably will not be screening requirements, I'm guessing, but could be wrong.
I have a follow-up question to you, if I may.
Sure.
I'm wondering about the source of the financial incentives that we have. Carol Gerard, who's in Massachusetts, Effort Coordinator. Carol knows a lot more about the national initiative for reimbursing for effort. But I wonder if that, you know, that often that's for Medicaid or people on Medicaid, that they can be reimbursed. But in this case, screening can be reimbursed. In this case, where does the money come from for the private insurers?
It is a question that we did not ask because as we kept trying to drill down to every single topic, we drove ourselves crazy and we could have had an 8-hour interview. But my assumption would be that these are private health plans. Once again, these are the Cignas, the Blue Crosses of the world, and they're thinking about how do they pay their providers. It's changing from fee-for-service to, you know, other kinds of bundled payment. And so it is that they take their budgets, assuming that they use to pay private providers, and somehow they devise an approach to incentives and a source of that incentive money. It's not, I'm sure, some kind of outside government incentive or anything like that in the context of the groups we're talking about here. Yes.
And so the audit means spending, you know, a few minutes
right.
with a patient as opposed to a couple of questions that may ask, do you drink? How much do you drink? How long do you drink? Leave it at that, which could be the trip into, in fact, an intervention sort of thing or further.
Yeah. We only have a sense on the require specific tool question. The rest, we do not have a sense. So in the sense that we say something like, is alcohol screening part of a broader screening instrument, including tobacco and whatever else, we don't have a sense. When we ask about the requirements, however, we said, do you have a requirement for a specific accredited, endorsed tool? We didn't say which, we didn't ask which one, but they said, what do you mean by that? Then we gave a list of several alternatives that are well known to all of us. So, but we do not, so if that small percent that requires, we're very confident that it's with a specific tool that they tell you what tool. And but the broader group, we don't know that information, unfortunately.
Other questions?
Yes, please. I have one about your very interesting program. And I'm wondering how it is intended, two questions. One, how is it intended to interact with more traditional counseling for the individuals who are participating? And the second is, as you do your clinical trial, what are the outcomes that you're looking at?
So the question is, how does it interact with a larger system? And I'll do you one better. How does it interact with a larger system? So we decided early on that this would not be imagined as a treatment. This is not a treatment study. This is right like pre-treatment. And one of the things we discovered early on in looking at treatment providers and probation officers and asking them, what do you want people to do in the first 60 days, very early on when people are falling out? And they mentioned things like just showing up is one thing. And so that's one part of it, just basically showing up is half the battle. The second thing they mentioned is the issue of just being organized, having your, and that's one of the things, actually the number one goal, you'll never guess, get a binder to keep your documents in. It's just basically having paperwork and showing up with your paperwork in order. It was unbelievable to me. So those two things, and then the issue of motivation. If you have a client that has been thinking about those things, in both of these systems, there's a long lag between even when people are, if they're motivated, there may be a long lag, as much as 6 and 8 weeks before they can get into treatment. So having a person who has sort of thought about it a little bit, and maybe, you know, tenderized or what, I'm not sure what the good word is. So I think those three things is just showing up, being organized, and being a little bit more motivated. Other than that, we operate outside the, you know, we're in the system, but we're not telling other parts of the system what to do. So we don't interface, you know, super well with the other parts. That's part of the design of the clinical trial. And then in terms of the outcome, so we're following people out. Measuring alcohol and drug use, and we do cheek swab drug testing as well as the traditional self-report, and also criminal behavior. So we access probation records, treatment records, add up to a year.
Was client resistance. And of course, motivational interviewing is designed around client resistance. So I wonder if one of the problems is that they don't understand what motivational interviewing is really about.
Yeah, that was sort of the feeling that in going through the data I was getting, that people were just sort of resistant to that type of intervention. And so maybe they were used to having gone to other treatment programs and they get somewhere that's trying to do motivational interviewing. And it's both it's something new for the clinicians who are implementing the EBP, but also for the clients to be in an environment where someone is just sort of feeding back what they're saying. Yeah, and so there definitely could, I mean, it's not surprising that some people would be a little put off or at least on guard with how that works. I think it's the small numbers, and then just a lot of barriers that fell into the different categories, and so nothing stood out specifically.
I've implemented many of these.
doesn't match my experience, it says. I mean, ACRA, we do a lot of ACRA agencies, cities, speaking patients. Those have been kind of much harder in some ways to implement because they are so specific than MI, which our clinicians have taken to fairly easily. So it's just an interesting example.
The woman in the back, please, and please stand.
I just, I'm an evaluator, and I've done lots of stamp sort of funded projects over the years. And one of the sort of concerns I have about your sample is just to get funded to do those things requires a certain level of organization, even of the provider agency, and capacity really to successfully want to compete for that funding and, you know, to convince the funder that you can implement. So I think in many ways you may underestimate when you think about generalizing that this is a sort of already a select group of providers who are implementing these evidence-based practices, and you may underestimate the number and kinds of barriers that would come with these EBT.
I would definitely agree with that, because all of the people who were part of this worked in organizations that had won those grants, that yes, they're at a certain level. And so if they're still facing these barriers, then it's clear that the smaller community-based organizations that don't get the same level of grant funds and don't have the same infrastructure are going to face even more barriers.
Other questions? Well, I want to thank our panel. It was great to hear how much ESPERT has really moved forward and is in the community and the academic and the health plan settings more than it certainly was 12 years ago. Thank you.